Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, and welcome to Radio Gorgeous's annual Man Week. It comes around the time of Thanksgiving, and we are very grateful to Jeff Dean to coming on to Radio Gorgeous to talk about his book, From Mohair Suits to Kinky Boots. Welcome, Jeff Dean.
Welcome, Jeff Dean. Yes, Jeff Dean is welcome, and I'm very grateful for that. Thank you very much for having me. It's very kind of you.
You have had an incredibly colorful and successful career and an even more colorful life. And could you bring us sort of back to your Hackney origins?
Yeah, I grew up in council flats in Hackney. Most of my family were in the same block. It was one of those old red brick sort of council estates. I mean, beneath us was my uncle Sid, who can I use a little bit of bad language or whatever?
Of course.
Was my uncle Sid and his four boys, and Sid was an interesting character. He was known locally as Joe Cunt. he was a cab driver and a street fighter and also a bouncer at a very notorious gangsters club. But the reason he earned his nickname was he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. And if ever he thought anyone was taking liberties with him, he would say, "Do I look like my name's Joe Cunt?" And at some point, everyone in the community decided that the answer to that was a resounding yes. And the nickname stuck. And that's what everyone, even his wife, called him that. Opposite us, I had there was my Auntie Bessie, who was actually my nan's sister, who weighed in at a healthy 34 stone. She was married to a chap named Will, who was a tiny little fella. I mean, the only thing these two had in common was that I think his weight went into hers four times exactly. She always referred to him affectionately by the name of Shithouse. So, you know, as you can see, it was a very affectionate, warm kind of upbringing. My nan and granddad lived on the same balcony as us, and they also had, they took in my nan's sister, who had mental health issues, as we say today, which was much better than the terms that we used back then. I mean, my dad diagnosed my aunt, as my Aunt Ginny, and my dad diagnosed her as being tuppence short of a shilling. That was his... she was an interesting woman. She used to keep budgies that she had close relationships with, and she had a quite a weird voice, and these budgies used to speak in the same, their chirps imitated her voice. But I remember she once said to me, "I had three budgies but they both died," which is one of my favourite family statements. So I grew up in this kind of really nice, it was a very warm environment, and actually it was great social housing. It really was very good. You know, the kids could play downstairs, mums could talk to each other on balconies and keep an eye on them. It was actually very practical and sensible, and they worked very, very well. So of course they stopped them and then started to build vertically instead of horizontally. And suddenly those next door neighbors that used to stand there chatting didn't see each other from 1 month to the next, unless it was in a lift that invariably stank of urine. So, and that was when we moved out of the area. My dad got a better job, and we bought our first flat in leafy Chingford, which is still East London, but very, very different from Hackney, where I grew up.
It seemed to me that, like, you were immersed in this, you know, teeming environment, you know, with, you know, surrounded by family, surrounded by multicultural influences. Everybody was families. You had Jamaicans, you know, all sorts. Everybody. And it was just the soup of family and sameness. And what I mean, well, is sameness is that you were the same as anybody else.
I mean, the word
there
is community. Yeah. I mean, I grew up amongst Jamaicans, Irish, English, Jewish, and latterly kind of Pakistanis. And it was all part of sort of one community, and each faction brought their own things to the party, which were great. I mean, the Jamaican influence specifically had a big impact on me. I was mad about the music. There used to be a record shop in Ridley Road called Music Land that used to get the latest Jamaican imports, and we'd kind of queue up for those. And the way we dressed as well was influenced by the young Jamaican rude boys, trousers worn a bit too short, which I still do to this day. Still wearing the same shoes that I wore back then. Yeah, it had a profound impact. And also, you have to remember, it was the only world I knew, you know. And there was no internet or anything of that nature for me to really see elsewhere. So that's kind of what I thought the world was like. And then we moved to Chingford, which was, you know, man, it was as white as a ghost. You know, everything was different. And there were cows and shit like that. You know, cows that had right of way, they could wander in the road. And I didn't know what, it was a big culture shock to me. I didn't like it. I used to get the train home to the old flats every single night. I also made the mistake of arriving in Chingford with a bit of a sense of superiority. You know, I was kind of a skinhead, suede at the time, and I was into my clothes, and you know, I thought they were all kind of yokels, which, you know, wasn't maybe a million miles off, but what, you know, what the kids around there may have lacked in sartorial elegance and musical culture, they made up for with an endless imagination when it came to matters of violence. I was literally stunned. How could this kind of area with a village green be so violent? I mean, I can remember going to a dance at the Chingford Assembly Rooms one night, and this huge Wild West style fight broke out. I mean, there were tables and chairs, and this balcony above, this vicar came out, yeah, like this cassock figure, and you know, he raised his arms and kind of appealed to peace to these, you know, warring teenage masses. And this fat bloke called Lips picked him up and threw him over the balcony. It was like, whoa! You know, this is, you know, okay. So, yeah, but it was changing schools and things like that as well, which
were difficult. I got the sense, I was going to say, but I got the sense that it was that very difficulty, that very, very much feeling alone and a fish out of water, that sort of spurred you on to become, you know, funny by way of self-preservation, class clown. Oh, as know, protection.
They always say that. No, they always
and
say
that performance, you know, part of you.
Well, I think people always, I mean, maybe, I mean, people always sort of say, you know, I was being bullied, so I learned to be funny. I mean, I don't know, if I was trying to be funny and people didn't laugh, I'd hit them. So, I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, using humour is a way of gaining acceptance. I mean, my whole family, they all thought they were comedians, and I grew up in that environment. I mean, I can remember, I didn't, you know, grow up knowing very much about my religion, which is Jewish. I didn't, you know, didn't particularly have any knowledge of it. But I can remember when I first saw that Radio Days, the Woody Allen movie, and I saw this kind of family arguing and laughing and screaming over a dinner table. It was like watching my family, and I was riveted to it, you know?
Competitive insults.
Yeah, yeah, you know? And so I grew up in that kind of environment, so I guess it's one of the tools that you utilize when you're trying to gain acceptance or work out your place in the hierarchy of the peer group you're moving in. You know, you use everything in your favor. You know, good looking people use that. I guess I use kind of clothes and things and my musical knowledge and my humor. I guess, yeah, I mean, I've never really thought about it, but yeah, I guess you use all those things to promote yourself, I suppose, yeah. But it was unwitting at the time. It was just, that's what came naturally, you know. If you're going up to a girl and you're trying to talk to her and you don't look like Paul Newman, you know, amuse her, make her laugh.
Gotta get some chat in there somehow.
Yeah, there you go, man. That,
use what you got.
Yeah. So
I wonder, also, because I, like you, grew up culturally Jewish, not religiously Jewish, not bar mitzvahed or anything like that. But I got something from your book and just reading about your mother. It's just a classic Jewish mother thing of everything is your fault. You know what I mean? Like, but that's the power. People think, oh, it's overbearing. But it's like, well, yeah, of course it's your fault. Because, you know, you can do anything. And every success is like, why not you?
I mean, I think there's... my mama had these great different adages that, you know... She always used to say to me, it's just as easy to fall in love with a rich girl as a poor one. Never found that. And the one really wealthy girl I ever did go out with cost me a fortune. Absolutely backfired completely. So terrible, terrible advice. But I think one of the things that you might be referring to is there's a passage when I moved to Chingford. I was coming home one night and I had like a 20-minute walk back to our flat, and there was three skinheads there. And they were looking at me, and I was dressed differently from them. I also used to walk with this really annoying Jamaican strut, which is kind of pushing yourself up on one foot as you go, which could be really annoying on a Jamaican. On a white 15-year-old Jewish kid, it's infuriating. I mean, I can see that. But I could see them there. You know, I felt like the captain of the Titanic must have felt when he looked through his telescope and saw a piece of ice, you know, saw a chunk of ice. I'm like, oh, no. Anyway.
Fair dues.
Yeah, here it comes. Anyway, I mean, I really got beaten about badly, you know. And I arrived home covered in blood and, you know, my clothes are ripped and I'm in a really terrible state. And my parents, my mother does her world famous impression of a Jewish mother, you know, she does perfectly. But then she rounds off with, what did you do to annoy them? Yeah, I mean, that is such a Jewish take on a random episode of violence. Exactly. You know, I didn't do anything. Well, you know, but being myself, yeah, maybe, but I certainly didn't interact with them. You know, I didn't insult them as I walked past, if that's what you're insinuating. I'm not an idiot.
But to me, that's sort of like, I mean, that's so natural. But to me, it's obviously like the reverse chutzpah. Because, of course, you can do anything.
Yeah.
You can annoy anybody, you know, you can do anything you want to do. And yeah. Obviously it was in your gift and in your power to annoy these people.
She really was. But, you know, she did have a kind of profound effect on me and my life as well. You know, she would continually correct my grammar, my spelling, you know, continue. I can remember years later. And she had certain things that she would zero in on. I can remember years later when I was in music and I had bands that were doing okay, I was in a meeting with, I think, the MD of CBS, which was soon to become Sony. And I was trying to renegotiate my contract to get a higher percentage so I would earn more of my money. And like, you know, which when you're doing well is something that you might be able to get away with. And so I was talking to him, explaining my case, and he was putting his side of it. And he said, yeah, but this is different too. And I went, different from. And he looked at me and I thought, oh, my God. Didn't get the percentage I wanted.
All right. Well, let's get back to the music, though.
Yeah.
So tell me how that evolved.
Music was always a big thing in my life. Earlier on, it was Jamaican ska music, but that was very much records, which is a different kind of culture from live bands. I think the first band that ever really spoke to me was like The Faces with Rod Stewart. I think they spoke to working class kids. They knew the language, you know. I mean, when Rod Stewart kicked footballs into a crowd, which I can remember him doing at a gig, you know, he scored a goal with every council flat kid in the building, you know. And I love The Faces. And, you know, I was very influenced by Rod Stewart. But the first thing wasn't, my first instinct wasn't to form a band, because that was just so out of reach, you know. But I tried to get my hair cut like him. And I went to Vidal Sassoon in Moulton Brown, clattered a picture, and I micromanaged the stylist through every snip. And in fairness to him, while it was wet, it didn't look a bad approximation. Unfortunately, my hair's kind of quite thick and wavy as it dries, you know? And I didn't look like Rod Stewart. I looked like the lead singer from a really bad band called Chicory Tip, who'd had a big hit that summer with Son of My Father. No one wanted to look like the bloke from Chicory Tip, not even him. And honestly, for that summer, every time I walked, this song had a very specific synth intro. Every time I walked in anywhere, my mates would sort of go, yeah, thank you, very funny.
To be fair, you would have done the same to anyone.
Oh, absolutely. But then, of course, that all changed with, you know, the cosmic sledgehammer that heralded the arrival of David Bowie, which, you know, was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen in my life. Going to those early rainbow gigs of him, supported by Roxy Music, and, like, we all had our makeup on and our outfits. And, you know, that was fantastic and life-changing and culture-changing. And, again, you know, he opened up our eyes to so many things because of, you know, he was like a cultural Pac-Man. You know, he had so many influences, and so many of the things that became facets of my life I drew from him. And I'm sure that's true of lots of other kids, particularly musicians. It was just awesome, very inspiring. Kicked a nation's sexuality up in the air, literally. You know, things have never been the same since. You know, if there's one person that, you know, helped gay rights in this country, it was David Bowie. I don't, people never really talk about that. They just talk about the fact that he was a self-proclaimed bisexual at the time. But so many people came out or tried things because of him. I mean, it just, you know, it was something that was never even discussed before. And suddenly everyone was at it. It was fantastic. It was really good. But again, I mean,
there was also a sort of egalitarian spirit to it as well. You know, like, you, well, in the fact that it wasn't just gay or transvestite or men or women or what, you know what I mean? It was just, right.
Honestly, it was so much just better than now.
Exactly. You know? Just rip off the Band-Aid and everybody get dressed up and go out.
You know, these days of kind of identity politics where everyone is concerned what faction, I want this one, I want a name for myself. If I don't get a name, I'm going to fucking stamp my feet. I'm different from him because, you know, I stand slightly to the right. You know, no one cared. You know, all that mattered was that you were happy and being nice to each other and enjoying each other and getting on with doing good stuff. And compared to now, it was a phenomenally rewarding period. You know, it was absolutely wonderful. And, like, you know, it was much more, without wishing to sound preachy, it was much more about what was in people's hearts and brains than it was about any specific label or agenda.
And it was also about the clothes, let's be honest.
Well, clothes, well, it still is.
Yes, you know, it's important.
You know, that's the subtitle of the book, really, isn't it? You know, our music, clothes and going out shaped my life and upset my mother. You know, no, it's an important facet, you know, always has been.
So what led you from that to punk?
I didn't take up punk very quickly. I mean, you know, punk's real roots were fashion, an art school, you know, really, which were not big in East London. So it was slow to take root there. I mean, you know, one of the first punk gigs I ever went to in East London was about to see a Geordie band called Penetration play at a club called The Spooky Lady. And I went with David James, who was later in the Leighton Buzzards with me, and also Modern Romance. We got there and there were only two other customers there, who were two girls who were, they'd both got their dress sense from, I think, St. Trinian's movies. They, you know, they looked like kind of rowdy schoolgirls. And as a nod to the punk spirit of the time, one had written fuck on her cheek and the other one had written shit on her forehead, you know. I mean, we didn't really like the band very much and we left early. We didn't say goodnight to shithead or fuckface either, you know. But then I went to see, pardon me, The Damned, a band called The Damned at the Hope and Anchor. And it was one of the most exciting things I've ever seen in my life. Three Chord Mayhem in a venue that was tiny, full of kids their own age, going mental. I mean, even the walls were sweating. It was so much fun. And for the first time, it was like a glimmer of, I could do that. You know, when you see, you know, when you saw Bowie on stage doing 12 costume changes at the Rainbow or Earl's Court, you know, it's just, as a kid, you can't do that. But suddenly seeing four guys on stage playing three chords in a little club and going down really well, you kind of think, yeah, that's possibly doable. So it kind of started from there, really. Yeah, I was living with a guy called David James who was bass player in some local band, and I put it to him and he was up for it. He knew a drummer called Kevin Steptoe, who was a delightful, very humorous human being. He knew a guitarist, and suddenly we had a band, you know. And it kind of really started from there and kind of moved pretty quickly. But I mean, really exciting, fun times. I mean, we lived above an optician's in Baker's Arms in Leighton. And God, we moved in there. It was such a dump. I mean, there were proper holes in the front room wall. And we didn't know a single thing about DIY, and neither did we care. So what should we do? We pasted sheets of newspaper over them and painted them white, which it kind of works on two levels. A, it actually didn't look as bad as you'd think. And B, every now and again, someone would lean against the wall and fall through, which was just fantastic. Yeah, we had upstairs was a photographer and his wife, a guy called Brian, who was one of the first Metropolitan men I ever met. He taught us about things like fresh vegetables and wok usage, you know, which was great, very grateful. He wasn't so Metropolitan that he wouldn't occasionally have a few beers and entertain you by bending over after dropping his trousers and producing a bunch of hemorrhoidal arse grapes, you know, at his party. He had this fantastic friend called Colin, who I think was an early Buddhist devotee. He was very into yoga and meditation, you know, which is very early for that. And he seriously believed all human beings had the potential to levitate. And he would try and convince us all this. And we seriously believed he was a cunt and kept encouraging him to give it another try, you know. it was very, very, very funny days. We used to rehearse in the flat. So the police and people would come round. So we dealt with that by removing the doorbell. God, we didn't pay rent for ages. We ran out of money and the landlord was always getting complaints and he kept sending all these threatening letters. And in the end, he sort of said, unless you give us access to the property, we're going to kind of, you know, break the outside door down and come in and kind of replace the locks on yours, you know. So he said, fair enough. And he did all that. And they drilled the locks out on the front door and it still wouldn't open because we'd nailed it to the frame. And from that day on, honestly, from that day on, we could only get in and out the flat, our own flat, via the kitchen window. You know, wonderful times. Sorry. They're very childish, all this, but they were very, very fun days. You know, I enjoyed it. I think probably much more than, you know, the next band, which was far more successful, for the most part, for me, wasn't half as much fun.
Well, know. How did you make that swerve from punk to salsa.
Well, we kind of, you know, the punk thing kind of ran out of steam, really. And, you know, we were all very different musicians in the band, and punk had kind of brought us all together. As that started to wear off, the differences started to kind of come out, you know, and I guess, you know, you could have tried to have made sort of double albums with all kind of different things on it. You know, I mean, kind of Clash went that route,
yeah.
You know, not that, you know, we're as good as the Clash or anything. Not suggesting that, but it just seemed. Also, Kevin, our drummer, was always, who was a fundamental part of the outfit, was always only going to be around for a period of time because he had a career plan, and he was always going on about leaving, and he was going to leave, and he was going to uni, and it just seemed that the best thing to do was to kind of leave it. And I didn't really know what I was going to do. But then my dad was working for a furniture company at the time, and he said, okay, well, you've had your fun now, but I can get you a job with my company for, like, I don't know, 28 grand a year and a car. And it terrified the daylights out of me. I thought I'd better do something else. So we thought, let's make a band to have hit records with. That's what we did. Let's earn money this time so we can make a job of it. So, you know, we auditioned by haircut, you know, and stuff like that, and tried to make a successful band, and, you know, to a degree it kind of worked, I think. You know, not immediately, but yeah, I did kind of, I mean, I enjoyed the American side of it. We had a very different image in America, different records out, and we toured gay venues and black venues extensively in the States, which, you know, and we played some fantastic gigs at some of the biggest clubs in America. Also some of the scariest, God, man, like we played a gay club called the Anvil.
Oh,
you know the Anvil?
No. Oh,
honestly, man, it was you know, they used to have there was two rooms downstairs, one for people into golden showers and one for those into anonymous sex, and for people into being peed on and anonymous sex, it was thoughtfully only a short walk between the two. There was a small stage for performing where it was everything from drag acts to live fisting shows, you know, which
and you were somewhere in between.
I mean, at the Anvil, when they said let's give a big hand to the next act, it meant a very, very different thing. Yeah, you know, we found ourselves performing at places like that, but, you know, it was all such a, New York at that time was amazing, you know, anything, anywhere, anytime. It was a really interesting place to be. Yeah, culturally,
well before things were cleaned up.
Thank you, Giuliani. I mean, you know, it was just amazing. It, to me, it was, I mean, I love London. I've always loved London. It was like the better London.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the better London. This is what I'd like London to be if I could relax a few laws here and there. But, you know, I love that. You can get a sandwich at 4 in the morning, go to a bar there, and, you know, it was wonderful. Absolutely, absolutely marvellous. So, yeah.
But this was also the start of you doing your research, which seems to have been a theme. You immerse yourself. I want to write hit songs. All right, I'm going to figure out how to write hit songs.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of, to be honest, I've done that with every aspect of my career. I mean, I'm a real enthusiast for other people's endeavours. I'm a bit faddy, you know, I go mad on things for a period of time, but I'm very, very passionate about the things that I like. And very often, they're the inspiring thing that makes me want to do it. You know, if I see a film that makes me really excited, I'd like to write a film like that. So, you know, I've never been the kind of person, I have no DIY skills. I can't take anything apart and put it back together. I mean, I'm hopeless. I mean, I can't draw, which also really upsets me because I'd love to be able to paint or whatever, but I just can't. I'm just useless. You know, actually a friend of mine once asked me along to what do you call it, like a life class where she was posing naked, and it was really, really good. You know, there was great music playing and she had projections behind her. She was fantastic. You know, never underestimate what other people do. I mean, all very well standing there kind of looking glamorous and that, but you know, what about the poses that are really awful and uncomfortable and you don't look good in? You know, she did all that and it was really brilliant. I was really impressed, and all these other people around were doing all these great things with charcoal and that. You know, I spent 2 hours and I got one tit, you know, and it looked like a fucking condom with a dot in it. It was useless, you know. It's like I literally have no skills at all, and it depresses me. But I do, with hard work, I can take things to pieces and work out approximately how they're done and kind of make a kind of blueprint, if you will, for myself. And I've done that with music, TV, film.
Exactly, those, you know, swerves. But also that's what I'm so interested in, because it seems from the outside, oh well, then I had this hit salsa band, and then I started writing TV, and then I thought, oh, I'd like to write film. And you've had success after success after success. You get an agent, you get hired, you get this, that. So, but that's what it looks like from the outside. From the inside, obviously, it comes from huge amounts of enthusiasm, immersing yourself in research, and luck.
Oh,
right place, right time.
I mean, luck is something that, you know, I can't overstate the importance of that. You know, somewhere there's another band that were better than the Beatles that no one ever picked up on, you know, because a huge amount of it is luck. I have got a kind of old school work ethic, which I don't think hurts. And I'm not, how can I put this the right way? I'm not afraid of hard work. And I think I'm a fairly good judge of my own abilities. And I think I know when I've got something that's all right and I feel good about it. And I'm quite happy to keep knocking on doors and to have doors shut in my face. I don't get depressed. I don't care if people say no. I mean, I'd rather they said yes to my ideas. Of course I would. It saves on shoe leather, you know. But I don't get depressed or full of self-doubt. And I will knock on 100 doors until I find the one that opens. You know, it's an essential part of what I do, because of course, you know, everyone turns everything down, always. That's how it all works. You know that. Everyone turns everything down. It's very, very rare that someone says, wow, this is fantastic. You know, come on in, make a record. Come on in, make a movie. It's not that, you know, if it happens to some people, it doesn't happen to me. I don't have those kind of connections or come from that kind of background. So, you keep faith in the work and you just get out there and knock on a lot of doors. You know, that's the only kind of strategy I've ever really had. I'm not clever enough to have anything better than that.
A sort of through line of the writing, of through words getting through to people. And there is a through line of just, why not me?
Well, I think they're both, there's a degree of truth in both of that. I mean, you know, I think it's so much harder for young people now. You know, I have three kids, so, you know, I see it firsthand, where they're expected to make astute career choices with, you know, long-term implications before they've had any life experience. You know, we didn't really have that pressure on us. You know, as far as my parents were concerned, as long as I worked and earned some money, they weren't that bothered. I mean, you know, they didn't nurture hopes of me being a lawyer, but I think that was always a bit far-fetched, and I think they knew it. And I got into law college, but only lasted 3 weeks. You know, on the first day I unwittingly had an altercation with a man at the station who transpired to be my lecturer, and I just shoved him and told him to fuck off. And I'm getting to, well, it was my first day. I was nervous. I'll tell you what it was, man. I didn't have, because I was a student, I didn't have any money. So my mum bought my train pass for me. And in those days, there was a mark on it or some code for what your gender was. My mum had bought it for me. So I had a, I mean, you couldn't do that. These days, you'd have to resurrect Alan Turing to cover every gender, you know. But in those days, my mum had bought it. So I come through and I got stopped for having a woman's pass. And I said, look, my mum bought it for me, man. And I just kind of gently moved this British, this underground inspector aside. And this do-gooder came forward, you know. I saw that. You insulted him. Oh, fuck off, you know. And I just shoved him. And I rushed. I didn't want to be late for my first day at uni or college. And then I sat down and he walked in and it was him. And our eyes met. Our hearts parted company. And I thought, I'm not going to really last here. You know, so 3 weeks later I walked out and got a job in a clothes shop around the corner, you know. Went home, cue mother doing yet another impression of a Jewish mother threatening to put her head in the oven, etc. You know. But that was it. That sorry, I've backtracked there.
Well, but also I wonder if it, because
but it, having a little bit of a blasé attitude, yeah. It's not the end of it. You know, you try something, it doesn't work. You know.
Not just the end of the
try
world.
Try something else, you know, as long as you've got a roof over your head and you can still eat. It's not a tragedy. And I think it's such a shame now with the pressures on kids that there's almost, in fact, with everything, that there's no room to mess up anymore. There's no room to fail. But failing in itself is not a tragedy. You know what I mean? It no one dies and it can be a learning curve, you know. Like, okay, well, this is what I got wrong there. Maybe next time I can try and compensate for that and get it a bit better. But, you know, with everything now, it's like there's this pressure to get it right all the time. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work creatively or artistically, you know, which is, you know, you end up watching so much rubbish on TV now, you know, because people haven't had the time or the resources to develop things properly. So, you know, corners are being cut and you get it there and, you know, people get commissioned perhaps for the wrong reasons, you know, and then you end up watching loads of junk, you know. It's like, why don't you let these people develop it, make some mistakes and then get it right? You know, that's how most of the good things, a lot of the good things culturally have come about. They don't always begin. There are some geniuses amongst us that walk amongst us, but they are few and far between. Most people get better at what they do as they go along. I think that's far more normal, you know, and that certainly applies to me.
I was going to say, because one of you had, tell me a little bit briefly about your television career, television writing career, because you started on Birds of a Feather and...
Did I start on it? I think, yeah. I mean, what had happened was I kind of left both bands. I was writing songs for a living. I'd work with Divine, you know.
Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Well, oh my God.
Yeah, well, I've written this song called You Think You're a Man, which in my head...
You're really a little boy.
In my head, it was going to be for Gloria Gaynor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew what I wanted it to be. I wanted a song with that kind of glammy...
Anthemic
thing. Yeah. But I also wanted it to, like, you know, there was a really... There was a good thing going on in gay clubs musically at the time. It was high energy, which eventually, in fact, possibly via You Think You're a Man, ended up evolving into what became pop music with all the Stock Aitken and Waterman stuff, you know, because they actually produced the Divine single. But that method of working, that kind of vibe... then became very important in British pop music. So I'd written it for Gloria Gaynor. Gloria didn't want it. Somehow someone sent it to Divine's people and it was like, you know, and it's like the happiest accident in the world, you know.
Genius.
It's one of them things. It's happenstance, but it's like, you know, if someone would have ever said to me, Divine instead of Gloria Gaynor, I'd have gone, what a great idea. But it never occurred to me. But someone had that idea. And it was fantastic, and I ended up touring with him a bit, and I was one of his backing singers. Amazing character. And as Divine, he was so outrageous, the things that he would say and do. But as you know what's coming here, when he was out of drag, he was this really nice, quietly spoken. I didn't spend loads of time with him out of drag, but he was really nice and quiet. And it was just thrilling to be working with Divine. What a buzz. I mean, being in a band and all that had been a buzz. But, Divine's an icon.
It's next level buzz.
And I'm a big John Waters fan. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of all the movies.
I know, they're a bit like Monty Python movies. They're better to talk about than to watch.
Oh, absolutely. But I saw John at the Barbican last year as a raconteur. He is superb.
He gets better and better.
Honestly.
A bit like yourself.
He's in his 80s, and he held the stage effortlessly for 2 hours with nothing but his mouth. And then it ended quite early, and then someone told me he's doing it again after an hour's break. Wow. And fantastically entertaining. And what was great as well was, for once, which doesn't happen anymore, the audience was interesting and dressed up. This used to be part of going out, man, and
how much of your income over your life do you think you've spent on your clothes?
Oh, you don't want to think about it.
More than on rent or some people, housing.
With some of them, some people talk about how much money they wasted on drugs, it's clothes, man. Clothes are...
Okay, well, I have an important question to ask you.
Yeah?
In the current climate, what are your feelings on athleisure wear?
Yeah, well, not for me. I guess each, like a lot of things, I think each era kind of gets the clothes it deserves a little bit. And I think gets the drugs it deserves, it gets the music it deserves. And I think the same's true of, the way a lot of clothes are made, it's the antithesis of everything I ever stood for, I'm not going to talk about my own shoes. Well, I am, because it's going to sound dull. But I put these pair of... I have a lot of shoes, I am kind of like the Imelda Marcos of East London. But I just thought, I haven't worn these for a couple of years. I just looked at this one, I'll put them on. But, these were properly made by someone, and I've had them 30 years, And that's what I like about clothes. They should be so... this kind of Primark mentality and things like that. I understand why some people have to, and I'm not, dissing them. I do understand economic realities and that, but it's just nothing that...
There could be more joy. You could bring a little bit more joy.
It's the whole thing. I mean, also, I buy...
Even from Primark.
But I buy things, more... I buy things, we used to call them secondhand, now it's vintage. I mean, these trousers weren't new to me, I picked them up cheap, in a vintage place. So, my career has not all been financially on the up. It's peaks and troughs, man. There are gaps where, if I get things wrong for a couple of years, certainly at times in my life, there was nothing coming in for a couple of years. So, it's not like I've got this huge disposable income to go out spending. So, I wash around, I know how to hunt a bargain. I like a sale, it's the only time Jewish men hunt is during sale season, it's like, basically. clothes, and I don't know. I was brought up with that. It was an East London thing, I can remember men wearing... nice mohair suits and stuff, and it was a dressing up thing. I think middle class people probably less so, and I think it's still the same now. You know, it's kind of making an effort. And I mean, this, you know, that goes on all over the world, by the way. It's not just a kind of working class thing, an East London thing. You know, like when you used to see those poor Italian gangsters, which they later made movies about, as soon as they got, you know, they wanted their great suits and stuff like that. You know, in Africa, you've got those groups like the Swenkers. You know, I don't know if you know about those. They're like gangs of, you know, they're like these black guys that you would think are, you know, Paris runway models. And they get together and they do fashion parades for each other and stuff like that. You know, it's a way of, I think it's a way of poor people trying to obtain parity or superiority over richer people. Mm. You know, it's making yourself feel good and knowing, like, hey, you might be this, but I look better.
Exactly.
And I think that's a nice thing.
Exactly.
You know, it gives you confidence in yourself. So
from TV to film, obviously you wrote Kinky Boots.
Yeah.
with all of that joy and understanding, because you had also written a TV show similar character.
Yeah. Well, I'd had a TV show on that I really liked called The Many Splintered Thing that had a character in it who was kind of a drag performer, a gay drag performer. And I really liked this character. I really liked him. And he was kind of the moral centre of this show. And I quite liked the fact that the moral centre of the show was this kind of guy who spent his life dancing around dressed up as a woman. You know, I kind of quite like that. It appealed to me. And the show didn't get recommissioned, which I was really upset about, because it should have been. It was just one of them things that it didn't. And I tried to see if I could resurrect it somewhere else, and that didn't work. And then this whole thing of Kinky Boots came up. It was someone else's idea. It was based on a TV documentary, which I hadn't seen. And I think the idea that the producers had originally would be to make something along the lines of the Full Monty and Calendar Girls, you know, where plucky Brits in adverse conditions do something mildly risque to progress their lives. That's basically the genre that it was. And that thing was a shoe factory making women's shoes for men. I was not very interested in it. I love footwear, but I couldn't see how a factory making shoes in a slightly bigger size was risque or controversial or anything. And I thought, this is really the most stupid idea ever. And I was going to knock it on the head. I was going to turn it down. And then I thought of that character that I had, and I thought, hold on, if instead of it just being about the factory, why don't we represent that world with a character, and we bring that character and make him pivotal in the story? Suddenly, I got that buzz. It's like, oh, this could be good. You know, this could be fun. You know, and I'd seen, you know, I was a big fan of Harvey's Torch Song trilogy movie. I'd worked with Divine. I used to hang out at kind of what then used to be known as tranny bars. You know, I'd had all that in London nightlife. So it was something that I'd kind of been close to and been around. I'm also, you know, a fan of Pedro Almodovar. And, you know, and I just saw possibilities of some of the elements of this film that I could sort of maybe try and bring into this, and suddenly it sounded interesting. I mean, it was much harder in practice. I mean, they liked the pitch and I got the gig, which was great, but you know, there was a constant friction between what I wanted to do and what the powers that be would allow. And it seemed to me that, you know, I wanted to write about a gay man with a life and a history who sometimes dressed up as a woman professionally. And I think the only side they were really interested in was a man who dressed as a woman. And, you know, So there was this constant kind of friction, and I didn't think it could really work without more background on the character and making him a bit more of a living, breathing entity, you know. So there was all this, there was always, and they were a bit embarrassed by the, you know, that Eva once said to me, you don't have to be gay to be a drag act, you know. Well, no, you probably don't. That's true, technically.
And yet?
You know, and yet, having spent a considerable amount of times in drag bars and going to drag things, I don't think I've ever met anyone that is straight. You know, but that was very much their way of thinking, you know. But
the accidental tranny.
Yeah, they just seemed a bit embarrassed by it all. Mm. I mean, you know, if you look, I don't know, the original posters of Kinky Boots, it's all Chiwetel dressed in a three-piece suit, you know, and the press release, it's like a cabaret artist, not a drag act, you know. And so it was a bit like that all the way through.
Yeah,
and
designed by committee.
Yeah, and well, it was a committee with a fairly conservative POV. I mean, having said that, I still like the film, but I do think that when it evolved into a stage show, it was embraced with a bit more, what's the word, joie de vivre, a pizzazz, whatever, because that's the theatre. I mean, although in fairness, you know, there's not that much more of the other stuff that I'm talking about in the show either. So maybe I was wrong, you know, maybe it didn't really need it because the show did super well, you know, super well. But there was much more, there was more energy about the show because of what the theatre is, you know, and it obviously went on to do really well and stuff like that, which was great. I mean, and it's nice to have played a part in it, even though there was a few lumps and bumps along the way. I can remember, you know, watching Gilmore Girls one day and Kinky Boots was mentioned in it, and on Friends, you know, and I'm like, fuck, man. You know, I did that, man. You know, I mean, maybe I didn't specifically do all that, but, you know, I had a really, you know, that show was still the story I wrote and the characters I wrote. Some of the words were changed. There might have been a scene taken in or added, you know, but that was my shit. And to see it go that thing, normally, you know, it's funny, I don't really get excited about stuff. I get a buzz on about work if I'm doing something good or I've got a good idea, and conversely, I can also get miserable if I'm working badly or I have no ideas. I don't normally take too much notice of all the other stuff. I just think, you know, I think I learnt years ago that therein lies the route to insanity, you know. Just cut yourself off from that, get on with the next work. But I can remember seeing it on Gilmore Girls and just thinking, wow, that's kind of good. You know, because I was as you can probably imagine, I was a really big Gilmore Girls fan. I loved Gilmore Girls. Just could have watched it forever. Loved it.
I was saying, I think my son just finished it.
Oh, it's just brilliant. It's old-fashioned writing. It's wordy, sophisticated comedy writing. You know, it's like the old Hepburn Tracy movies. You know, it's that stuff. You
front
know.
Page.
Yeah, yeah, it's just great. You know,
chatty, funny.
Yeah, I mean, there was a bit of that in recently in the other show they made. What's her name? Meisel, Mrs. Meisel. Bits of it.
Yes.
I didn't like all of it.
Yeah.
But there were bits of it that reminded me of that period again, which my favourite bits all reminded me of that. Yeah.
Mm. And then lockdown happened and you started writing again.
Well, what actually happened was, actually I stopped writing. Every job I had just vanished immediately. My kids, for one reason or another, were all at my ex-wife's. They had an outbreak there, so they couldn't come back. You know, the way everyone was mentally paranoid, you're going to die at that time, you know, which I have to say I never really was. So I really was properly isolated for quite a long time. And other than missing my kids, I was really looking forward to it. I had no work to do. I'm an avid reader. I love watching good movies and TV. I just thought, I'm going to sit here and watch and read myself into oblivion. which is what I started to do, and I was thoroughly enjoying myself. And then about a month in, I strolled down the street into Gax, which is my local off-license and convenience store, run by two delightful Sikh brothers, and I walked in. And without me having to say a word, they put a baguette, a block of Cracker Barrel, cheddar, and a bottle of Lafroy on the table, on the counter, before I'd spoken. And I thought, that's not a good sign, really, is it? I think I might need some lifestyle changes. So I thought, I need to get back to work. I need to start doing something constructively with my time and stop eating cheese bread and drinking whiskey. So I kind of really got back into, you know, putting some stories. I started off by putting some stories on Facebook, getting some feedback, which was nice because it was also a bit of human contact, albeit online. Then when Morris said to me about making it a book, I then sort of settled down to, okay, maybe I'll stop publishing all these for nothing and, you know, giving the stories away for nothing. And so it gave me something to kind of, you know, to crack on with, which was a big help during that period. It was an awful period, wasn't it? And I felt at the time it was an insane period.
I also got a sense from your book that there were a lot of stories untold. It's a glorious collection of hilarious anecdotes and some serious stuff in there as well. Are we going to get volume two?
I'm not sure, is the honest answer. Okay. There may be. It seems an obvious thing to do. I mean, a very old friend of mine read it recently and enjoyed it. He said, I'm really surprised there kind of wasn't more about the band. And I hadn't, you know what? I hadn't given all that much thought. There wasn't a huge editorial process for me here. It was as I fancied writing something, I did. But I think, ironically, that you end up with something by doing it that way, that actually, if you look at it as a whole, does give a sense of maybe what mattered to me.
Yes.
As if, in a way, as if it had been much better planned. You know, I mean, why didn't I write more about being in a successful band? Well, you know, maybe that didn't mean, you know, I left it reasonably early. And, you know, the thing is with band experiences is when you write about them, they're band experiences, man, you know. And you can be a bit of a jackass and have a funny story once, but then it's another band thing. And there were bigger bands and better bands, you know. And whereas the guy that I worked for when I was working for a catering company as a kid, I've only ever met one human being like that in my life. You know, I worked for this guy who ran this catering operation at Walthamstow Town Hall for large Jewish functions, and I was just like a porter and a runaround. But this guy was amazing, man. You know, he was just amazing. Like, he would send me out first thing in the morning to bring him back 100 untipped senior service, and by 8 in the evening he'd run out of cigarettes and was tapping them off of other people, and he would bark at it. But he was wired into everything like Davros into the Dalek Empire. But these functions were huge life events for the people that were doing them, and there was a genuine desire not to let these people down. And, you know, it was fantastic, you know, and he seemed smoking and barking orders, you know, and he was like, you see him behind that, you wouldn't really see him, you just hear his voice, his rasp, you know, just like a one-man Chernobyl in a tux that had seen better days kind of thing. It was like, but he was fabulous, you know, and I'd never met anyone like before or since. And like at the end of the day, when the people had gone, and there was just the tables left to be cleared, his final order of the day would be fruit off, flowers off, fuck off. You know, I mean, it was like, just, that's a genius. You know, you're fantastic. So, you know, compare him to every guy in a band that I ever met, and I met a lot. You know, that guy sticks in my head more. If I go round to my local newsagent and find out that the guy I see every day has died, and I end up crying in the newsagents, you know, with the guy's son, we're standing there crying together, that's a profound day for me. And it was, you know, only happened in the last few years, and it's never happened to me before or since, where I've just exchanged really tears, shared tears with a stranger whose name I'd only just discovered. So it's natural to me that that would stay in my head, you know? And so that's really the only kind of editorial process from my idea there was. So, I mean, yeah, there could be more, but I don't want to... I don't want more of the same, you know. There needs to be other areas to kind of focus on. I have got something else in mind, which might make another book, which would be the same but different, which may be more interesting, but we'll see. Let's see if anyone likes this one first.
As if people aren't going to like it. Jeff Jean, it has been an absolute pleasure.
Blimey, have we done our time already?
We have. Can you imagine?
Have I yabbered on a lot? I'm sorry. Mind you, I'm meant to, really, aren't
that
I?
Is your job. Yes. Yeah. That's the gig, Ben.
I've never really been one of the moody, silent types. So I don't even like people like that. I like kind of talkative individuals with a lot to say, you know. So
you do surprise me.
Well, I do. Listen, thanks for being fantastic and making this very easy. And if I have gabbled on a bit too much, I apologize to everybody.
Fuck that. Jeff Dean's From Mohair Suits to Kinky Boots, How Music, Clothes, and Going Out Shaped My Life and Upset My Mother is out now from Muswell Press. And for more gorgeous voices, go to radiogorgeous.com.